You know, I feel like every time I start a new show with people that I don't normally work with, I say something somewhat inappropriate, and then people have that like nervous laughter, and it's like they want to laugh louder, but wait, this might be kind of inappropriate.
Maybe I don't
want to get busted on the inappropriate thing going on.
Let's not
go there. Exactly.
You know, I mean, who doesn't want to start a Friday morning with a little bit of hair pulling and butt smacking? I mean, who doesn't want to start the day that way?
That's the PC I know. The inappropriate one.
You know, we don't have to wait until noon to drink on essentially a holiday Friday. Shouldn't have to wait until noon to do that either. You know, but it's a pre-nooner. I guess that would be.
It's 10 a.m.
It's close enough.
We're close. We got a couple hours till noon.
I mean, we're good in, like, if we were in London, we'd be good, right?
Oh, we're good to go, yeah.
So if we were somewhere over the Atlantic.
Yeah, it's already noon. It's 10:03, so it's 12:03.
So it's close enough.
We're good.
It's close
enough. Pop it open.
He is Chris Borti. I'm Patrick Creighton. We are in for John and Reg today on In the Loop. Mitch Bilimaki at the Master Controls on the other side. Because, you know, Fig, he deserves days off too, allegedly. I love Fig. I got it.
We all do.
Fig probably deserves the days off more than anybody else on that
show.
Oh,
yeah.
You know, John is
hardworking.
Do we think John is fishing?
Probably.
Is he fishing or is he, like, still in bed?
I mean, it's 10 a.m.
Yeah, and it's a holiday, so it's a holiday for him.
So he might still be in bed, you're saying.
I think it's 50-50. Either he is fishing.
I think he's up. If he's up, he's out fishing.
I'm going all in on fishing.
Or he's sleeping.
I think he's fishing.
I'm putting it all on black. On fishing.
What is Reggie doing right now? Is he sleeping off a hangover? Was he, like, slamming the tequila last night? Because, I mean, it's a lot of tequila. We've seen Reggie drink a lot of tequila in this building and still be standing up. So,
Giving away all the secrets.
Was Reggie having a really good time last night? You know, because
I think it might have been the night before.
Well, I mean, he's had the time off. So yeah. You could have extended celebrations.
Is he celebrating every night?
If you didn't,
I don't know if he's celebrating every night.
Listen, if you didn't,
but
have
I don't know.
To, if you didn't have to come to work yesterday and you didn't have to come to work today, would you not have stayed up late and partaken in some adult beverage and probably still be sleeping or rolling out of bed right about now?
I can say yes to two out of three of those. I'm up late all the time anyway. I'm not a big drinker, so maybe not, but I definitely would just be rolling out of bed if I was not here.
The only thing
I'd just be rolling out of bed for sure.
I can tell you I wouldn't just be rolling out of bed because whether or not I need to get up at 6:30 in the morning. My dog needs to get up at 6:30 in the morning. Now, that doesn't mean I can't go back to sleep, but I usually fail in that scenario.
So once you're up, you're up. That's it. There's no going back for you.
It sucks, but that's kind of how it works, you know? And once you're up and you've had to get up, turn on a light, you know, do the things that you always do when you first get up, which is, you know, your bladder wants to remind you that it's time to get up. And then you gotta let the dog out and then give her a cookie. Like, these are the things. Okay, we're up now. Now we're up.
It's time to go.
All right? Dog's going to jump around.
She's no going bark. Back to sleep.
I have to let her out. I got to give her a cookie. Yeah, at that point, we're up. And that's how that works. So while it hasn't changed the outlook of what my day might look like on a normal basis, the Astros definitely changed the outlook of their team for 2026 yesterday. News that broke right about 11 a.m. yesterday. The Astros signing Tatsuya Imai. It really changes the outlook of the entire team. And as I said, you know, on Christmas Eve, they might be a stalking horse for him because his market appears to not be developing. Very similar to how Moritani Marcama's market did not really develop. And he winds up signing a short-term, two-year, $34 million deal with the Chicago White Sox that if a similar situation was going to happen with Imai, that the Astros should very well could be involved in that scenario. Mm. And sure enough, thank you for a happy new year, Dana Brown. And I gotta say, and Jim Crane, because we know that none of these, anytime a deal is worth like more than, you know, $15 million a year, Jim Crane had his hands on it to a degree.
Yeah.
To a degree. So Jim Crane, Dana Brown, giving all Astros fans a little something of a happy new year with a new starting pitcher, one that potentially has the kind of stuff and the kind of ability to make up for the loss of Framber Valdez.
Yeah. PC, had that move not happened yesterday and we were still sitting here essentially waiting for the Astros to make a move, like, how would your mood be today in terms of what they done or have not done this offseason?
Well, I did have a segment planned yesterday about the Astros being in cryogenic stasis and just absolutely nothing going on, and how they're slow playing the market because they don't want to spend. They don't want to go over the tax line. They've already been over the tax line 2 years in a row. If you go over the tax line 3 years in a row, it becomes a 50% penalty on every dollar you spend over the tax line.
Yeah.
They've already, you know, lost international bonus pool money. Their compensatory draft pick for Framber Valdez leaving will be after the fourth round instead of after the second round because they're a taxpayer. You know, so there are penalties that come with being a taxpayer, especially if you're not advancing deep into the postseason so that you're kind of making all that money up. When you're a taxpayer, but you at least go to the ALCS,
yeah,
you've made up a lot of playoff money that more than offsets the tax money. Mm-hmm. When you don't get to the ALCS
deep, yeah,
or even don't get to the playoffs, the tax hurts a little bit more. Nobody knows that more than the New York Metropolitans or the Flushing Mess, as we call them. They paid a whole lot of tax to not go to the postseason and not even be close to it.
Goodness gracious.
But, you know, with the Astros signing Imai, and then you think about all the depth moves that they made with Ryan Weiss and Nate Pearson, and they made the deal for Burroughs from Pittsburgh, and they've brought in a team that started the offseason with a ton of questions in starting pitching, just a team that had no depth at all. You didn't even have a full rotation, and you had no depth. You have question marks with guys who are coming back from injuries. Some guys who, you know, you expect to start the season, and at least three that you expect not to start the season due to injury. So there's a lot of question marks around the Houston Astros and their starting rotation and who might be in it. And now you look at that grouping and you say, hey, you know what? There's a lot of guys who can potentially give you innings enough that you may now have enough of a surplus of major league caliber starters. When you combine the fact that there's been interest in Isak Paredes, there's been interest in Jake Myers. We know the Astros are shopping Christian Walker.
Yeah.
There is potentially a lot more meat on the bone here. Not in the free agent market per se, but in the trade market. The Astros right now, you know, they need a backup catcher. You know, they really need a setup arm, like a seventh inning arm. And it sure would be nice if they could get an outfield power bat, because you've got right now in your outfield, Cam Smith, who you hope is going to take a step forward, but you hope.
Keep developing, yeah.
Jake Myers, no power whatsoever. Zach Cole has power, strikes out a lot, unproven at the major league level. Jesus Sanchez, when he got to Houston, didn't know how to hit, looked like he'd never worn a glove in his life. And the never worn a glove in his life part, more of an issue for me than looked like he couldn't hit. Because I will expect that, okay, he will regress or progress to the mean in his case, because he'll be going forward, and he'll go back to being a guy who, like, rakes against right-handed pitching.
Yeah.
But what we saw from him defensively was he looked like he'd never worn a glove before.
Yeah.
And that is much more of an issue for me. You can't just be an absolute disaster in the field because, well, if I want a guy who can't play left field to play left field, I could put Jose Altuve there. And I don't want to put Jose Altuve there.
I don't want to go there again. No.
You know, but, you know, the Astros, you still have Jason Alexander on a team. So Costanza, I don't think Costanza will be in the starting rotation, but I do think he'll be in the bullpen. And I think that's a guy who fills a role that I think is very underrated in Major League Baseball right now, which is long man, multi-inning reliever, spot starter.
Yeah.
The Astros, because they're the Astros and they might be cursed, the Astros are going to have starting pitching injuries because days end in Y. So you need guys who can give you spot starts, maybe give you 4 or 5 consecutive spot starts. You need that type of guy. And Jason Alexander, to me, fills that role. His metrics don't match up exactly the way that the Astros usually look for guys, right? He's not a guy who throws real hard. He doesn't have like a ridiculous spin rate. He doesn't get a lot of strikeouts. He strikes out like 7.5 guys per 9, which is a really low number for a starter. Starters usually close to 9. But he gets outs, right? His for people who understand advanced stats a little bit, right? FIP, fielding independent pitching, being a number that the advanced metrics guys look at and compare to your ERA, that if your FIP is a lot higher than your ERA, they'll say, well, this number indicates that either the pitcher might have gotten a little lucky, might have gotten benefit of some really strong fielding. If the FIP is lower than their ERA, well, the pitcher got bad luck. Like these are guys who should have gotten more outs and should have given up less runs. So Alexander's FIP is about a run higher than his ERA, which would indicate he was the beneficiary of good fielding. Okay. Which, I mean, that's part of why you have Carlos Correa.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
And Jake Myers, you have Cam Smith played with very well defensively. And you know, maybe he got a little bit lucky, but I'm also a believer that sometimes guys make their own luck. And he was a guy who was able to get soft contact. He was a guy who was able to get ground balls and got himself out of jams that way. And I think there is a place for that guy. Maybe it's not the number 3 starter, but as a guy who maybe has to be your number 6 starter for a period of time, or comes out of the bullpen when your starter only goes 5 innings and gives you 2 innings of relief to kind of save your bullpen on that day, when you have to have a bullpen game. Hey, I got a guy who can go out there and give me 4 or 5 innings, not, you know, 1-1-2, 1-2-1, you know, you can get through a little better. And I think that's a role that's the Astros recognize the value of that role more than a lot of other teams do.
Now, when it comes to Christian Walker, backtracking a little bit here, how likely is it, in your opinion, that they're able to, I guess, unload him if they want, you know, if they really want to go that way, unload him before we actually get to spring training? And what do you think? You think they can attract something and bring something back worthwhile, or someone worthwhile that can come right in and contribute for him?
I'm not sure what kind of return you're going to get, because I think the return is going to be based on how much they pay down. How much they pay down on Christian Walker's contract. Christian Walker makes $20 million for each of the next 2 years. If they should not be willing to pay more than half of that. If they're paying a total of $20 million of the $40 million remaining on there, you should be able to get somebody that either somebody that can contribute, or somebody that is more than a lottery ticket prospect.
Yeah.
Somebody who's at least the AA level. And isn't, you know, 26.
Yeah.
You're not looking for somebody who's 17 years old and is in rookie ball.
Needs a lot of work.
Well, how many things could happen to somebody between 17 and 24?
Lots.
How many things happen?
Life happens.
How many things happen to you between 17
exactly.
and 24?
So life happens.
From that point of view, you're talking about the lottery ticket.
Yeah.
Does he develop? Does he not develop? Does he have injuries? You know, does
too many question marks.
Does he develop whooping cough? I mean, there's a zillion different things that could happen there. So that's why I call them lottery tickets, because they're too young to project to anything realistic. There's too many things that can go on. But can you get, if you trade Christian Walker and you pay down half his money, can you get a legitimate seventh inning arm? You know, can you get, a decent prospect? Not a guy who's a top 100 guy, but somebody who, say, has an upside to be something close to a major league regular.
Okay.
It might be a couple of years away, but has an upside to be, you know, if you get a 23-year-old kid in AA who's, say, has power, has speed, plays a position of need for you. Okay. But I think the best version for that, if we're talking about Christian Walker, is getting a bullpen arm. If we're talking about Isak Paredes, you're looking for a young starting pitcher. Okay. Somebody who's under 20, 25 or under, is either in AAA and ready to come up, or has gotten at least some, like a little bit of a taste of the majors, but basically has 5 years of control. Is, you know, Isak Paredes' arbitration number is expected to be about $10 million. Mm. So if I'm trading Isak Paredes and I'm getting a prospect pitcher, I save my $10 million. Mm. And the Emi move based off from SpotTrack, because they have Imai in at $18 million, so that's his actual salary.
Yeah.
Then there's an additional $3 million in incentives that he can get pitching 80, 90, and 100 innings. Once he hits it once, it goes for the whole contract, which he's not going to be in anyway. But the idea is, A, if he hits those numbers and he winds up making $21 million, that would put the Astros, according to SpotTrack, about $6.8 million under the first tax line. So it stands to reason that further moves are going to come where they're going to decrease salary. So that, because look, they still need to get a backup catcher. And I think they paid Victor Caratini $6, $7 million last year. So if you want that kind of player, that's kind of the range you're in. That's going to put you right up against the tax. So they need to get themselves more flexibility. So a guy like Walker or Paredes, one of the two, is probably going to go. I know a lot of people don't want to move Paredes,
yeah,
but he has the most value, and he can get you back that what you covet most, which is young starting pitching. So what they will do, we will see. But clearly the Astros are not going to be done. They probably need to reallocate some funds, but they are not even close to being done just quite yet. Coming up next, you know, college football, New Year's Day, they go together. But sometimes even the smartest coaches do really dumb things. Next.
Houston, let's get in the loop.
You better get ready because we're going to show up and show up.
With John Lopez and Reggie Atitula. Always live, always local.
So what do I do? Just take a nose hit?
Just take a good whiff of that.
It's my first. Whoa. God almighty.
You're in the loop on Houston Sports Leader, Sports Radio 610.
I'm Badge Creighton. He's Chris Partee in for Reg and John in the loop, Sports Radio 610. Mitch Bilimaki at the master controls on the other side. I've gone from a standing position to a seated in a very slow chair because this was Seth's chair.
Yeah.
And Seth is a very large
human being. He's a tall man. Yes.
So right now I probably like barely have half my head in the camera. So I'll work on that in the next segment. Also made the mistake of not checking the volume when I plug my headphones in. Apparently Seth is really deaf.
It was blasting.
It was on freaking max. I put my headsets on. I was like, whoa. Yeah, if I wasn't awake before then, well, I am now. That was...
Didn't even need coffee.
Man, I tell you, between, you know, when your dog has bad gas or Seth having the volume at the maximum level, one of those two things, equal. Equal. So, college football and New Year's Day, kind of synonymous. This, you know, huge college football.
Peanut butter and jelly.
And we thought we were going to get some really good games yesterday. Well, two of the three games were absolute duds because they were colossal ass kickings. But the one game that actually had some had some drama, had some excitement to it, may have been decided because Kirby Smart did not live up to his name.
He was not smart.
And he did something very, very silly. It was a fourth and two play where they sent out the punt team. And then almost called timeout. So Georgia goes, oh, you know what? Let's send our offense back out. And the plan was we're going to use a hard count. We're going to try to get them to jump offside. And if we get a free first down out of it, great. But they were not supposed to snap the football. Just a hard count and try to draw them off sides. And then if you get them off sides, okay, then you snap. But you only snap if you're getting the draw. Then this happened.
Lined up as if they were going to punt. Now they run this unit on, probably trying to get Ole Miss to jump offside. Or will Kirby Smart have them snap it on fourth and two? At their own 33, nothing would surprise. Stockton is out there. They do snap it. And he's under pressure. And sacked. And the ball has come out. Suntarian Perkins bunch of fans stunned. Kirby Smart.
Kirby Smart. Well, wow. Apparently did not tell his guys, do not snap the stupid football unless you've drawn them offsides. And they wound up snapping the ball to a very surprised quarterback who then got drilled into the turf.
Talk about a lapse in communication. How do you not communicate that to your team, to your quarterback, that no, we're not going to actually snap the ball unless they jump offsides? Like, how does that not get communicated at this level of football?
I would think that that is how they practiced the play.
Yeah.
And maybe the center has an IQ of 6, but I have a hard time believing that they've never practiced that play.
Oh, come on.
Hey, if somebody jumps, snap. Otherwise, don't snap.
You're not pulling out this play in a spot like that if you have not practiced it. I find that very hard to believe. There's no way this has not been practiced. Maybe not in every practice, but it's been practiced before.
They've practiced a lot.
They've gone over this, okay? They've gone over this. I don't understand how this happens. That and lack of communication.
It gave Ole Miss great field position, which they would then take advantage of and score a touchdown to make it a 10-point game with 9 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. And believe it or not, even after that debacle, Georgia would come back to tie it.
It's Georgia.
They would come back to tie it. But left just enough time on the clock for Ole Miss to get a 47-yard field goal, take a 37-34 lead. And then they did have one more chance with like 6 seconds to go. Mitch, are our computers working? Because I'm going to be fair to Mitch. The computers have not worked most of the morning, as we heard Sean Pendergast warn us during Crosstalk, sponsored by D&M Leasing.
Technical difficulties.
That the computers have been taken over by AI. Skynet is going to murder all of us right here in the studio. Oh,
goodness gracious.
Well, come right up. Those computers are going to come to life.
Hey, we've had a good run. We've had a good one.
It was nice knowing all of you.
It's been nice.
So here is how the game ends. And if you thought that the fake punt was a debacle, wait till you hear this.
Go back to the monitor. Mathis is feeling like an excruciating ending to a classic game. Does common sense need to prevail here?
Well, yes, but we do have rules we have to follow. Mm-hmm. If the ball is recovered legally after it goes 10 yards by a grounded player, then the clock does not run.
Okay.
So as then Greg talked about, if you muff it, yes, then a second would run off. But if you don't, if you just fall on it, then there's no time off.
So that means that Georgia will have an opportunity to go maybe take a shot here, which is that was a big mistake by Ole Miss. You just got to go slap the ball, hit the ball, and the game's over. Instead, they waited and allowed Georgia to recover it with Cash Jones laying down on the field.
This would be the all-time miracle of miracles. And of course, now, if you're Ole Miss, you're also concerned with a defensive penalty. So, there's a chance, and a much better one than a moment ago. Stockton, the Georgia receivers really aren't moving. Very few people are moving. They're going to try to lateral it many times. Cash Jones. Lawson Lucky at the 35. Back for Jones. For Colby Young. They've gone backwards to the 30. Now Lucky at his own 26. Flag thrown. Cash Jones. Up for grabs for Young. He's trying to get rid of it and does. And they take Stockton to the ground to end it. Perkins and Andrew Jones. There is a flag down. It's against Georgia. This one is finally over. And Ole Miss wins 39-34.
I guess they decided instead of throwing, you know, up the Hail Mary, they were going to, it's written in the beginning. First of all, we're getting the, well, you know, there's rules that we have to follow. Thank you, Captain Obvious.
Somebody's got to throw that out there.
Gee, did you see that hit? I mean, his head exploded right out of his helmet. What's your analysis on that, Bob? That had to hurt.
Oh, my goodness.
And then you get, like, the receivers. They only run, like, 8 yards.
Yeah.
And then they just stand there. The quarterback's holding on to the ball like he's trying to chuck it down the field. And all the receivers are 8 yards out. They're all ready to do the 900 hook and ladders.
Wait. Where's the scramble drill? Like, what are we doing here?
It looked like they didn't know what they were doing.
Apparently.
Which would not have been the first time in this game.
Again, communication. Where's the communication at?
It was... For a team that is as good as Georgia and is historically good as Georgia to have multiple fourth quarter plays.
Blunders.
Where they look like they do not know what they are doing.
That's rough.
And they were the 3 seed.
Yeah. So they are no longer that.
Now, after 2 years of the 12-team CFP format, of all the teams to have a week one bye.
Oh, yeah.
7 of the 8 have lost.
1 has advanced.
Yeah, and they may have...
I'll be honest, I didn't think they were going to advance.
They may have tectonically shifted college football.
Yeah.
We'll get into that a little bit later on. But coming up next, we'll be joined in studio by the general, John McClain. He joins us next.
Welcome to the party, pal.
I got a 6-month backlog in New York scumbags I'm still trying to put behind bars.
Come out to the coast. We'll get together, have a few laughs.
Who gives a f***?
Yes, I was wrong about you. You're not such an
ass. How's that, ass?
Shh. It's okay. I've done this before. I'm that f***ing Energizer Bunny.
Listen to me.
Sister Teresa called me Mr. McClain in the 3rd grade. Your friends call me John.
F*** off.
You're neither, Ed.
Yeah, I got a deal for you.
But I let you live.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
He is not only our resident Hall of Famer and resident movie star, but he is also our living, walking, talking, breathing encyclopedia of all things Houston sports. He is the General John McClain joining us in studio to start off the new year. And, you know, I said resident movie star. Now maybe resident movie director?
Mm.
John, you've got a movie project that you're working on that I'd like you to tell us a little more about because it very much involves football. It involves Texas, and it's all right here. And you know, we've talked to some big name former players and Hall of Fame players. What's going on with this Prairie View Interscholastic League documentary that you're working on?
The director is Mark Burns, who's done a tremendous job. He and the writer Joe Holly, an author and longtime Chronicle columnist, have had to go through like 40 hours of interviews. My job was to do most of the interviews. Rob Lynch has done incredible jobs. Producer Scott Nethery, executive producer. And it's the four of us. We've traveled to Canton. We've been to Waco, San Antonio, Brady, Key Largo, Florida, to interview Jimmy Johnson. Mm. And the premiere is going to be, and you guys will be getting invitations.
Yes.
On January 30th, it'll be available to the public on February 1st. And I tweeted a lot about it yesterday, and I retweeted everything this morning. And when I get home, I'm going to tweet more because I'm trying to get people talking about it.
The word out.
It comes out, yeah. Because we're hoping everybody will retweet all the information. But the title is the PVIL story, Separate But Equal, ? And it's about high school football in Texas before integration. And Rob Lynch came up with that idea we had finished working on one with my bum, Wade and Wes Phillips, and I recommended Southwest Conference. And then Rob started telling some stories. I said, where'd you hear those stories? He said, from Joe Green and Kenny Houston. I said, we got to hear more of that. And the stories, the only three members of the Pro Football Hall of Fame still alive, Joe Green, Kenny Houston, and Emmett Thomas from Angleton. And we have interviewed former players, coaches, administrators. Michael Hurd, former Post sports writer, was at USA Today. And Michael was working, retired from Prairie View A&M. He wrote the definitive book, Thursday Night Lights, about high school football in Texas with the Prairie View Interscholastic League, all black, and what they went through compared to the all-white University Interscholastic League. And of all the interviews we've done, none of them complained about it. And people are like, well, why is Warren Moon interviewed? He grew up in L.A. Because when he was a little kid, he read a story in Sport Magazine about the greatest quarterback nobody knows of, and it was Eldridge Dickey from Booker T. Washington here, who went to Tennessee State to play for John Merrick because he let him throw the ball. And so Warren fell in love with Eldridge Dickey and said he played quarterback in the yard and the street. I'm Eldridge Dickey. And when coaches, when he was little, wanted him to play a different position, nope, I'm playing quarterback. I'm Eldridge Dickey. And he tells a great story about it. He wouldn't be where he is today without Eldridge Dickey, who died here in 2000. Dickey was the first black quarterback drafted in the first round, 1968, by the Raiders. And his story is unbelievable. Al Davis drafted him, never played him at quarterback, had no intention of doing it because he had Daryl LaMonica coming back as MVP. He had George Blanda, and he drafted Kenny Stabler in the second round. Why would he draft Eldridge Dickey? Well, it's keep him away from the Chiefs and Hank Stram, their arch rival. And what Stram has a quote, what the Raiders did to Eldridge Dickey is criminal. And Santana Dotson, who grew up here, is dead. We interviewed him, and he played with the Raiders. And he started getting emotional when we were talking to him about Eldridge Dickey. And said, why are you getting emotional? He said, because we thought he was the one. He was the black quarterback who was going to show all the white general managers and owners that a black man could play quarterback just as well as a white man. But then Al Davis never gave him a chance. He had 4 years as a backup. And they let him play in a preseason game against the Chiefs in Birmingham. And he was so great that two Chiefs, his opponent, defensive tackle Ernie Ladd, and Buck Buchanan picked him up and carried him off the field to the Raiders tunnel. And we've talked to people that were there. Why did they do that? Because they had such great respect for what he did in that game and his talent, but he never got to show it any other time. And it was just an unbelievable story. Turkey Day Classic. Ralph Cooper's been great. Ralph is one of the all-time best media people here. Just voted in the Gridiron Legends of Texas. And Ralph is talking to him was unbelievable. Talking to Jimmy Johnson. People are like, what's Jimmy Johnson got to do with all-black high school football? And we went to Lubbock to interview 97-year-old Pete Regas, who was the head coach of Corpus Christi Miller in 1960. Johnny Rowland was their best player, and he led them to the state championship, first integrated state championship in Texas history. And Johnny and the coach, Pete Regas, told us the best team they played was not Wichita Falls that beat in the finals, but Port Arthur Jefferson, and Jimmy Johnson was the best player. So Rob Lange calls Jimmy, and Jimmy says, I can't remember last week, much less 1960. And then Jimmy thought about it. He said, come on. So we went, the four of us went to Key Largo, met him at his restaurant, sports bar. He was great talking about the times of all black PVIL and all white UIL and about that specific game in which they lost 6-0 and Johnny Rowland's 60-yard touchdown run. And so it's been a labor of love. It's fascinating. It's gratifying. It's frustrating. Joe Green, when he was at Temple Dunbar, they let them use the white stadium from Temple High School, but wouldn't let him dress in the locker rooms because they were black. So they had pregame, halftime, and postgame in the end zone. Mm. It could be raining, lightning. Yeah. And Joe said, I saw a lot of majorettes. And Kenny Houston played at Lubbock Dunbar. And when they were on the road in an old bus in the Piney Woods of East Texas, and they had to go to the bathroom, no gas stations would let them use it. So when enough of them had to go to the bathroom, they drive down into the woods. Bus driver would open the thing and tell them, don't forget to take toilet paper. And they would all go out and then come back down the bus and then go play their game. And Joe Green never had a roof over his head until he got to North Texas. Never had water during a game or practice. They bring him a cup. What's that? It's water. What do I want with that? Well, for dehydration, what's that? I've never had water. You get water in practice? Mm. They never had his ankles taped. He couldn't believe he fought him. He didn't want his ankles taped. And then when they did it and he saw how quick and fast he was, he's like, damn. And that's how he became the greatest defensive tackle in history.
First time you get your ankles taped results in the first time you as a guy shave your legs.
Yeah. Because when you take that tape off, when that tape comes off.
That was first time I ever had my ankles taped. That was a
does not feel good.
Life-altering experience.
Does not feel good.
Anyway, I'll let you guys know when it's going to be available on February 1st and how people can see it. But we're really excited because we think 15 months we've worked on it.
Wow.
Mark Burns has done a great job, and we're like, we think we've stumbled on something big thanks to Michael Hurd's book. And I would encourage anybody, if you have any interest in this, high school football in Texas during the period of the Prairie View Interscholastic League, check out Thursday Night Lights because it is enlightening.
That was 7 minutes of education. And
we love it.
Now I'm really looking forward to seeing this documentary because there is so much that I'm going to learn about the history of Texas high school football and not being from Texas. Obviously, I didn't grow up with any of this.
Me either.
And I am always fascinated by the evolution of sport and things that how sport has changed. You guys know I'm kind of a baseball historian, so I'm well versed in how the evolution of baseball.
Yeah.
But to see it, football, not just football, but here at just the local state level, at the high school level, the evolution of football is really compelling story to me.
I grew up in Texas, in Waco, and I knew there was an all-black high school conference, but I never paid any attention to it.
Yeah.
And Kenny Houston and Joe, they said they never had any interest in playing the white guys. They didn't pay attention. They knew that there was an all-white league out there, but they were more concerned with winning theirs. Elmo Wright, who invented the end zone dance and played for the Cougars and the Chiefs, Elmo went to Sweeney High School and led them to the state championship, PVIL. Before the next year started in school, they told all the black kids, go across the tracks to the white school. Okay. Hmm. So they did, and he led them to a UIL championship, back-to-back championships by Elmo Wright. When people see what we're doing, they'll be shocked at all the players who played in the all-black Prairie View Interscholastic League, and I was shocked. And there's one, I got to tell you, one more great story. Bill Bradley, Super Bill Bradley, when he came out of Palestine High School, he was top quarterback in the state. Longhorns got him, of course. Jerry Levias was in Beaumont, and I had heard about him, but he was in the PVIL. And so they played a big 33 All-Star game back then, Texas All-Stars against Penn State All-Stars, and Jerry was one of three black players on the Texas team, coached by Bobby Lane and Doak Walker, two Hall of Famers. And Bill Bradley, nobody wanted a room with Jerry, and Bradley said, if he can play, I'll room with him. And he did, and Bradley threw him a couple touchdown passes. They won. They've been really good friends ever since. And when we were interviewing Bill, we had Jerry come in a back door where he couldn't see him, and Jerry came up and kind of stood to the side. Hmm. And Bill knew somebody was at his periphery. And finally, while I'm interviewing him, in the middle of the interview, he looks. And then they jump up and start hugging each other and crying and everything. It just was so emotional.
And the name of the documentary again?
Is the PVIL story, Separate but Equal. And I tweeted a 30-second teaser yesterday among a lot of others. McLean_on_NFL, And that teaser is Mark Burns did a great job. It is powerful.
This is something I am now very, very interested to get to watch. So
well, you'll get to watch it on January 30th.
All right, I'm going to keep that date out, man. Yeah. I'm ready to go watch that.
I believe that's a Friday, right?
That's a Friday. Yeah. Everybody in the media, in Houston media, is going to get an invitation. We're going to have a lot of players who were in it, and we're invited a lot of other players who are interested. We got like 30 who confirmed the first day, a lot of former Oilers, some former Texans, and can't wait.
He's General John McClain with us in studio for the first time this year, and we'll have more with the General coming up next. We'll get into your playoff-bound Houston Texans. On the other side, Chris Partee, Patrick Creighton, in for John and Reg. In the loop.